So someone who is 70 years old, you're telling me, can change their thoughts, change their patterns, and break the trauma patterns in their life.
So your thoughts are extremely powerful. When they have that information, they go, I actually have the power to change. And having that power and knowledge is already step number one. We have a negativity bias as humans, so we tend to dwell on the negative more than the positive. So when you repeat things like, I'm not good enough, I'm a loser, I'm this, I'm that, you're reinforcing pathways in your brain.
That's why we focus on the negative, is because our body and our mind is like, how can I change that?
The biggest part of productivity is actually recovering. If you say you're going to do something, stick to it. I will guarantee if you do that for 30 days, you will change your life.
A lot of people get confused between visualization and manifestation. What's the difference? Hey everyone, and welcome back to A Millennial Mind. Today, we are going to do a deep dive into how you can change your life by just changing your thoughts. You can rewire your brain, you can rewire your thoughts, and you can completely change your actions by doing some very simple things. But before we get into this podcast, I'd be so grateful if you could press the follow, like, and subscribe button. It's totally free and really mean the world to me. But let's get into the episode. Nicole, hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Millennial Mind.
Thank you so much for
You're the host today because you're sitting in that seat.
Yes, this is my good side.
This is the only podcast I've ever sat in the seat. I feel like a new woman. I might sit here more often. I don't know why I ever chose that side.
My book is a change your mind, change your life. So I thought I'd challenge you for today.
Love the plug. Just so good. I want to talk about your book for this entire time because before we sat down, I was already like, tell me everything. How am I going to change my thoughts? How can I change my mind? How can I rewire my negative thoughts? Because at the moment, I'm feeling a bit stressed. And I know I was like, tell me what I can do in 2 seconds because I'm lazy and I want to know. So we're going to get into that. Before we do, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Nicole, a neuroscientist, and I wrote Rewire, which is the proudest thing, the thing I'm most proud of. I was just saying that before the podcast. I did my BSc in neuroscience and in organizational psychology because I wanted to bring neuroscience to the masses, make it accessible to people. So It's great that I've got the platform and the book to be able to communicate science.
So, I love it.
And thanks for having me on here because
my pleasure.
Let's talk about it even more.
I love it. But what is neuroscience?
So neuroscience is the study of what's happening. The way that I describe it is the hardware component of the brain. So what are the mechanisms? What's the neurobiology? What are the neurochemicals at play within the brain that make us behave in the way that we do? That's what my interest was in.
And when you say they make us behave in the way that we do, what does that mean?
So we have connections in our brains called synapses. They are little sort of ends of neurons. And according to how you've experienced your life and the things that you've gone through, adversities, your upbringing, you create a set of sort of prints in the brain that are unique to you. So you have these synapses that create pathways that ingrain for your habits, behaviors, your personality, who you are as a person, which will be wildly different to everybody in the whole world. So we're all very different.
And at what age do these pathways get created and blueprints get created?
From childhood up until 25, that's when we are most susceptible to change. And then we even can have neuroplasticity, which is the ability to change neurons, synapses into old age.
Wow.
So up until the 90s, we didn't believe that adults were capable of neuroplasticity. But the word plastikos, plastic, comes from the Greek word plastikos, which means to be able to mold and shape.
Wow.
So we've discovered that the brain can continue to change as we age. So we can create new habits, new behaviors. That's why the book is called Rewire.
So someone who is 70 years old, you're telling me, can change their thoughts, change their patterns, and break the trauma patterns in their life?
Yes.
No way.
Absolutely. They're actually using neuroplasticity as a therapeutic intervention for dementia, which is really interesting at the moment. So,
groundbreaking.
Not my area of expertise, but there's some groundbreaking research coming out to show that we can improve potentially cognitive decline in Alzheimer's patients, which is remarkable information for us.
That is amazing. I mean, you know, I just recently recorded a podcast just now on societal pressures and expectations that we have on women and men in society. And I think that it's causing a lot of mental illness at the moment in terms of this comparison culture that we live in, mm-hmm. this rules that we have to follow, the expectations that we have on ourselves to achieve things by a certain date, to do things, to act in a certain way. And I know it's had a significant impact on my life. And a lot of the time when I am trying to break out of these patterns, I often remind myself, you know, I'm trying to rewire my thoughts from like 28 years ago, or I'm really trying trying to break the mold here. And habit setting is a really, really hard thing to do. I want to talk about somebody who's in their 30s, because a lot of the people that listen to this podcast and watch this podcast are kind of in that age bracket.
Yeah.
And they're millennials at the moment who are struggling with some trauma that they've gone through in their life. And trauma is subjective, by the way. Every single person I know on this planet hasn't had an easy, upflowing, incredible life with no troubles.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, like you said, that these small things that we go through in our childhood, that we then go through our teenage life, that we then go through our adulthood, they just build and build and build.
Uh-huh.
And I want to kind of take like a case study here of somebody who is struggling with something that happened in their childhood.
Yeah.
It keeps coming up for them as a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like they are unable to ever walk away from that. So let's just take something like jealousy, for example. A lot of people, you know, struggle with jealousy, and they'll say, well, it's because as a child I was, you know, not given any attention. And then in school I was, you know, in the bottom class. And then, you know, in adulthood, you know, people would always say that they were better than me, and, you know, had a lot of comparison. So how does somebody tackle those feelings of jealousy and rewire their brain to change them into a positive thought?
Just to backtrack to explain where these things come from, we create a blueprint through our childhood, which then becomes automatic to our patterns of how we exist. You know, you don't think about how you're going to brush your teeth, how you put on the light, how you open the door, how you make your coffee. And so it is with habits and behaviors. So these behaviors of jealousy have become an automatic pattern. Now, the brain likes to stay safe. So even if the fear of the discomfort of the unknown is more confusing for somebody than being where they are. What I mean is, when we know where we are, even if it's where we are is wrong for us, we want to change. The fear of not knowing how we're going to feel being different can be almost as sort of damaging for us and scary to try and make that change. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So it's like when people are going through grief, it's not like they want to wallow. It's just like they're too scared to be happy. Or no?
Yes.
Right?
It's the fear of the unknown. We like, even if what we know is wrong, the fear of the unknown is more scary. Okay, so generally speaking, that keeps us stuck in these patterns. But understanding that is already that penny drop that people need to understand. When they have that information, they go, I actually have the power to change. And having that power and knowledge is already step number one. You know, acknowledging that there's something you need to change. Knowing that your brain is plastic, meaning that you can change these things. So if you are somebody that reverts to jealousy, that's an automatic pattern that's been ingrained through repetition. You know, neuroplasticity requires repetition. And if you've been repeating it for 20, 25, 30 years, it's going to be something that's deeply ingrained. But we can change it. You know, over time, these things can rewire into new pathways. So you start to sort of see where you're going wrong. The brain has an amazing ability to self-correct. We call it experience-dependent plasticity. So we can actually make new synapses according to what we've experienced and correct ourselves as well. People always think that if they do something that's either a failure or they do something wrong, that's bad. But actually, it's kind of like you're adding data to your brain. And you're saying, okay, this is what we've just done, but we can change that to do something else. So the next time I'll be better prepared. And that's one of the things that I talk about in the book, is preparing for setbacks and kind of having a visualization of where you want to be. Because when you put yourself in the future, you can start to close that gap between the unknown and where you are right now. And as you close that gap, it starts feeling easier and less scary. So even though you've been repeating this pattern of jealousy, knowing that you can be somebody that doesn't behave in that particular way means that it will be easier when you get to that point.
Okay. In terms of habits, though, because like you said, jealousy is a habit. Okay, so in terms of habits of negative self-talk, I think a lot of people struggle with that.
Yes.
And I definitely struggle with that a lot of the time. And, you know, one thing I found is that in those moments, sometimes there's nothing that will stop me. I will punch myself to the ground. And only when I'm like, I'm tired of beating myself up, that I'll be like, okay, now I'll listen to a podcast. Now let me do some deep breathing. Now let me, you know, read a book. But in the moment where I just feel like I'm worthless, I'm useless, I have nothing more to give, I want to give up. How do we start changing those things that we say to ourselves?
Well, there's a couple of things. So we have a negativity bias as humans. Firstly, so we tend to dwell on the negative more than the positive. So it is actually easier because we ingrain information, negative information, more easily than positive.
Why?
It's a survival mechanism, right? So if somebody leaves one bad comment on your Instagram, but 3 really nice ones, 10 really nice ones, you'll most likely go to bed worrying about that negative one, because we want to know how we can correct that, right? It's a survival mechanism. Obviously, you know, a social media comment is not threatening, but as an evolutionary species, it would have been threatening, you know, in previous times to receive negative information.
How interesting. So that's why we focus on the negative, is because our body and our mind is like, how can I change that?
And somewhat wired to be like that, but we can change that. And the other thing is, we have something as humans that differentiates us from other animals called metacognition. So we are able to observe our thoughts. Does that resonate with you? Have you ever had that moment where you're like, I'm thinking these thoughts and I'm kind of observing myself?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. That's a really powerful tool, because we can actually detach ourselves from the thoughts. So if you are in that mood where you're going down a ruminative state and you want to, I put quote unquote, be in that state, you can just detach yourself and observe. By observing, then you can start naming. So how are you feeling? Why are you feeling like this? Okay. When we start putting names to the emotions and kind of putting logic to them, we recruit the frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is responsible for higher order thinking, logical thinking, problem solving. And that normally, it works in tandem with the emotional brain to some degree, that neither is ever switched off. The emotional brain is larger than the frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is called the neocortex, neo meaning new.
Okay.
So it differentiates us from other animals.
Right.
And the limbic system, the emotional brain, tends to override and overpower. When we start naming our emotions and putting logic to how we're feeling, we recruit the frontal cortex back online. So we're kind of saying, okay, this is how we're feeling, but we can start to analyze it. Over time, through neuroplasticity, you can actually strengthen the connection of the frontal cortex, that there's a better two-way communication system between the emotional brain and the frontal cortex, so that when you are going down a path of rumination, you have more control over the situation.
Wow, that is so powerful. So when you're talking around like the frontal cortex and all of these different analogies, I don't know what they're all called. I'm literally just like, I didn't really pay attention in school in science, so I'm like confused. When you're talking about naming your emotions, what do you mean by that?
So there's actually a wheel of emotions, which sounds crazy, but okay. I actually have one printed out, and it has not all of the emotions, because it's very complex, but there's a lot of them. I think there's over like 150 words on there.
Wow.
It starts from like anger, joy, sadness, and then it breaks out. So, you know, there's like sort of branches of anger where, you know, and you actually accurately naming, because surprise, for example, can be your surprise in a good way or surprise in a bad way. I can't remember the exact examples that are on this wheel, but accurately naming means that we're recruiting the frontal cortex again. Just think about it as the CEO of your brain, the part that is more logic, can make decisions, whereas the emotional brain tends to act on emotion.
So let's just say somebody at home right now is like, I'm stuck in this negative self-talk. I beat myself up and I feel a lot of guilt for a lot of things that I do.
Yeah.
Right? When I set a boundary, I feel guilty. How do I stop feeling guilty? How do I activate that front part of my brain?
Observe it, name it. You can even journal it, because, or talk about it with a friend. When we have these thoughts of guilt and rumination, they reside in areas of the brain that take up the whole brain. When we start to generate words, like what we're doing right now, or when you have to journal, let me backtrack a little bit. Do you ever get that feeling where you're like, oh, I feel a particular way, but I don't know how to explain it? And then as soon as you try and explain it, you start to realize that maybe you don't actually feel like that at all.
Yes.
Yes. That's generally what happens. These thoughts have no beginning and end in our minds. They run seemingly incoherent. As soon as you journal, as soon as you talk about it with a friend, as soon as you name it and you acknowledge it, you start to realize that you have more control over the situation. And it puts you back in the driver's seat.
So let's just say I'm somebody at home right now who's like, I set a boundary with somebody at work that I wasn't going to go ahead and do this thing for them. I set a boundary. I said no. Now I'm feeling really guilty, because I know that somebody at work, it's not them that's getting impacted. It's my client, or it's this random person. I really care about the client. So I feel terrible. What do I do? I'm observing. I know that I'm right. I know that they are taking advantage. I've had to set a boundary because they've taken advantage so many times, but I feel sick to my stomach.
Okay. In that respect, you probably are feeling stress, would you say?
Yes.
And you said that earlier, which is one of the tools I wanted to give you, which is the physiological sigh.
Okay. So
the physiological sigh is the quickest way to bring your central nervous system back down into a parasympathetic state. So for anyone that's listening, sympathetic is active, stress, fight or flight. Parasympathetic is rest and digest, so relaxed. Okay, so these two systems work in tandem with one another and they switch each other on and off. Both are good. Neither is bad, neither is good. Okay, we need to feel stress sometimes, but we need to recover from it. The physiological sigh is the quickest way to come back to a place of relaxation. So let's do it together. It's okay. A double inhale and a long exhale. So Dr. Andrew Huberman did a research study at his lab, and they showed that this is the most effective way to bring your parasympathetic system back down. So I, before talks, before podcasts, like if I'm feeling stressed, I will do that, like 5 to 10 breaths. And the perfect thing about this wonderful tool is that it's in your back pocket all the time, and you can kind of do it discreetly as well.
Well, I'm doing it now. I'm
to some degree.
Yeah, like, need to do it all the time. that's really helpful.
Yeah.
So observe the thoughts. Right, we've observed that I feel this way. Now I'm doing this breath. Right, yeah. How many times? 5, 10 times.
5, 10, 20 depends. The higher your stress system is, you know, is, then the more you'll probably need to do it.
Okay.
There are days where I do 5 and I'm like, okay, that was perfect. There are times where I do 20 and I'm like, it's still not helping, but you know.
The one challenge back I always get from people is like, I get it. I know I need to do my breathing, and I feel it's the same. When something bad has happened to me, I don't want to do it. All I want to do is curl up into my bed, feel sorry for myself, and scroll through Instagram to make myself feel worse. I'm one of those people, and I don't know if people do this, when I'm sad, I listen to like the world's saddest songs and like make myself feel even more sad, because I'm just like, if I'm going to be sad, I might as well just go all out, you know? It's like if I want to eat junk food, I'm just like, I'll go all out. And if I want to be healthy, then I have to be healthy. I'm very all or nothing. I don't know what that says about me.
Well, the music thing is not that uncommon. It's very common for people to do that because we want to feel emotionally connected to someone who can resonate with us. We want to belong. Okay, so in groups and out groups, as social beings, our entire being is to be social and to feel connected with other people.
Got it.
You know, loneliness is one of the most detrimental parts of our psyche. Mm. So music, it's really interesting. It's cathartic.
Yes.
Because you start to realize that there are other people in the world that feel the same way that you do. And in a way, it helps you release those emotions as well, because you're putting words and naming how you're feeling.
How interesting. Yeah. Okay. That's actually so useful. I actually did an exercise, really funnily, with some people that I do a workshop with every Sunday. And we were talking about negative self-talk.
Yeah.
And one of the exercises that I asked them to do was to write down the things that they say to themselves. And a lot of them wrote these negative things down, like, I'm not good enough, I'm a failure, no one likes me. And I asked each and every one of them to go on camera and say it to me. I was like, tell me I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
Tell me I'm a loser.
Yeah.
And all of them were like, and I was like, say it.
Yeah.
I was like, tell me. And they were like so hesitant and they felt awful after. And it's so interesting because you hesitated so much to say it to me, but it's your first thought.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing I always say to people is like, just think about what you're saying to yourself, because you live with you.
Mm-hmm.
You live with you.
Yeah.
But that's the habit that I think, and the loop that's hard for people to break.
Yeah.
What's one thing that you can tell people in that moment to do, bar the breathing and the observing?
There's so many things.
Really?
But I think when I explain it to people, and then I'll give you the tool at the end, people start to kind of understand how powerful thoughts are. Okay, so in 1995, there was a neuroscientist who did a study, and he took two groups of people. He told one group that they had to learn a 5-finger piece on the piano, and they told the second group that they only had to imagine that they were playing this 5-finger piece on the piano. And they both had the same levels of neuroplasticity in the brain. One was just imagining it. the other one was actually doing it. So your thoughts are extremely powerful. So when you repeat things like, I'm not good enough, I'm a loser, I'm this, I'm that, you're reinforcing pathways in your brain.
No way.
Okay, that for me was like penny drop, because it really starts to show how important it is that we pay attention to the things that we say to ourselves. So, you know, I have clients that will jokingly say things about themselves. I'm like, don't say that. Don't say that. And I, like, you know, there are times where I don't even say things like, I'll have a talk. There'll be like 600 people. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm nervous. I'm freaking out. And then I'm like, stop that right now. Because if I say it, I start going down the self-fulfilling prophecy, down this route where I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Now, this is, you know, the tool. Your brain has a confirmation bias. It wants to be right. If I say to you, how many blue BMWs did you see today? Because say you want to buy a blue BMW. And I say to you, how many did you see today? You're like, oh my God, I saw so many. I saw 10. And then I go, how many red Renault Clios did you see? You're going to be like, I don't know, because I was only paying attention to the blue BMWs. So you're only going to pay attention to all the things that reinforce that you're not good enough, that you're a loser. And when there are moments in your life that show that you are good enough, you're going to discount that. And that's not maybe even an active discount. You're just going to overlook it. That's really important to really pay attention. When we pay attention, we start telling the brain that we want to change something. Because otherwise it just becomes part of the subconscious. You know, about 90-95% of our brain operates on subconscious, as I said, those automatic patterns, behaviors. When we bring it to our attention, we start saying, okay, we actually want to make a change.
So this is why affirmations are so important, because you're affirming those thoughts can actually change your life.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the science of affirmations, because a lot of people are like, this is woo-woo. I'm not going to stand in the mirror every day and say I'm amazing or I'm beautiful. I don't think I am. I feel like I'm faking it. And actually, a lot of people say to me, you know, I struggle with affirmations because I don't feel like they're real. What do I do? How do I change my thoughts?
For those people, I would say that affirmations probably work better if you journal. You know, if you write out what it is that you want, what it is that you want in life, what are the things that you want to change? Because so to make changes, neuroplasticity, we need two neurochemicals present, acetylcholine and norepinephrine. I won't get into the nitty-gritty of it, but all it is that you're bringing attention to it. You're saying, this is what I want to change. Now, let's look at it from a different example. If I put on a French tape in the background of your life every single day in the studio, and I say you're going to learn French, but you're doing something else, you're not going to learn French. You have to pay attention to the words. As a child, you can learn passively, but as an adult, you need to tell your brain, this is important, because there are so many things in your day to day. There are images, sounds in your background all the time. The brain learns to filter out what is important and what isn't. If you say to yourself, this is important, that's when the brain starts making changes towards it. So if by affirmations, you're saying that this is important. If people don't want to do affirmations, they can do the opposite, where they're saying, what are the things that you want to change? The narratives that you're trying to change. I'm not good enough. Why? Stop writing it down. What do you mean you're not good enough? And then you start to realize that actually, maybe it's not true.
One thing my therapist told me, which actually has always resonated with me, when I was struggling in a relationship, I said to him, you know, this guy said this to me and it broke me. And he said, who else has said that about you? And I was like, well, everyone thinks it. And he was like, so who has said it to you?
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of anyone. And one person doesn't dictate who you are, but your own thoughts can dictate who you are. Yeah. And that's why they're the most powerful things, because they're repeating over and over and over again in your own mind. But the one thing that I always struggle with is in that moment when I'm in that negative cycle, how do I break the cycle?
I have a whole chapter of this in the book, actually.
I know.
Yeah. It's called Creeping Normality, because over time, these little things that people tell us start to shift our normal as to how we perceive ourselves, what we believe about ourselves. And there's a whole activity in there that helps you reconnect with your true core values. Mm. Because a lot of the programming that we have is from peers, people before us through our childhood, maybe things that were said to us, you know, this was an ex-boyfriend.
Yeah.
That has a huge impact, you know, and as I said, you know, the brain likes to register negative stimuli more easily because we need to know how to change that. And then if you then reinforce that with your own beliefs, so you start looking for, you know, patterns in your day to affirm this belief that you have about yourself. I already told you, your thoughts can create neuroplastic changes in the brain. It sort of becomes a snowball effect.
Wow.
And in the chapter, you do this whole little activity where you can sort of reconnect with who you are. I don't want to spoil it because it's so good.
Yeah.
But every time people do it, I've done it in corporates before, people have this penny drop moment where they realize that actually it's always been them. It's always been you. When you have to describe who your ideal person is, genuinely speaking, people describe themselves. They don't realize they're doing it.
What?
Do you want me to do it?
Yes, let's.
Okay. So I want you to describe.
God, to me? I'm like, no, I don't want to do it right now. No, I'm joking. Let's go. God.
The dictionary version of an ideal person. Like, who is this person? You don't have to say it out loud, but who is this person to you? An ideal person, the dictionary version of an ideal person.
Someone who is happy, someone who is kind, someone who's funny, somebody who is successful, strong.
Okay. What are their values?
Kindness.
Okay.
They have to be compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
This is the person I'm aspiring to be. I wouldn't say it's 100% me, but I'm like listing all the people. They have to be very caring.
Okay.
They have to be really thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be...
That's fine. What do you have in common with this
How
person?
Interesting. How very interesting.
Did you just How describe yourself? Or at least a version of yourself?
Yeah, I would say on my good days.
Yeah.
Didn't describe all my flaws. By the way, I'm not all of those people all the time. But I would hope to be like that.
Generally,
I would say some people would describe me as that.
Yeah. Generally speaking, we are describing either ourselves or a version of ourselves, you know. We're not describing something completely different.
Oh my God, that is the most amazing exercise. The person that you love the most is you.
Is you. You are the ideal person to you.
So nice. That is honestly so powerful. That's crazy. How did you think of that?
I meditate a lot. And my thoughts and... I write about it again. A lot of the times we make subconscious decisions all the time. So I'll meditate and I'll like plant a seed for something that I want to know. And that just came to me in a meditation. When I do it with people, they realize that it's always been you. That's the name of the activity. It's always been you. And it's a kind of moment where people go, oh my gosh, why do I talk to myself like that?
Yeah, I really do love myself. Yeah. And like, I don't have to hate myself to be normal. And, you know, I think in our society as well, I don't know if you feel this as a woman, it's like, when I watched the Barbie movie, have you seen the Barbie movie? One thing I recognize that I did is when she was so confident, I was like so shocked. So Barbie comes on and she's like, I'm so pretty. I'm so amazing. And I was like, huh? And I was genuinely so shocked at my reaction. Like, this is another thing I've been doing recently, and I think it's since I've been reading more, I'm so aware of my reaction to things.
Right.
So really weirdly, I had somebody on the podcast and I said, what would you like to drink before she came? And she said, I want a coffee. And I was so shocked because I was like, huh? You're like a nutritionist. And I thought you were going to ask me for a herbal tea. And immediately I was like, why did you think that? Why did you assume that? And I was like, oh, because I think coffee is not that great for you. And I think I'm a bad person because I have coffee so much, because everyone always tells me I shouldn't have so much caffeine. But if a health professional is now saying that they're having coffee, that's my automatic thought. Mm-hmm. And it just, even with a Barbie movie, when somebody comes on, they're so confident. You know, I meet confident people all the time. I would say I'm quite confident myself. But I don't think I'm like, I'm so beautiful. I look so beautiful today. And I think if I heard someone say that, I'd be like, huh? And what that made me realize was how ingrained our thoughts are from such a young age.
Mm-hmm. We're taught to apologize for, I don't want to brag, but I just got my master's. I don't want to brag, but I've just written a book, you know?
Yes.
We do that. We do that a lot.
And I think that's linked to the kind of like that self-worth piece where it's more acceptable in society to be like, nah, I'm not doing that well. It's all right. Rather than be like, I'm actually doing really well.
Yeah.
I'm really, really happy. You know, we don't want to say, I love my life.
Yeah.
Sometimes I really want to be like, I love my life. Right now, I don't feel that way, by the way. But there are some days where I'm like, I love my life. And I feel I would never say that to anyone.
Yeah.
And it's like, why? Why? And if you don't say it to other people, you might not be saying it to yourself.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to make other people feel better,
mm-hmm.
by demeaning the things that are going on in your life, you're probably doing it to yourself.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to then get out of that. You talked about visualization a little bit
at
the start of this topic. A lot of people get confused between visualization and manifestation. What's the difference?
So by visualizing, we start to close that gap. We start to sort of see how we could be in the future. So what do you want? Who do you want to be? What kind of habits do you have? We can create pathways through thought alone. We already established that through the study that I spoke about. So if you want to embark on a new habit, like running in the morning, visualizing yourself, going to bed, waking up, not snoozing like you always do, putting on your clothes, putting on your shoes, and getting out the door means that it will be easier to do that.
Wow.
In the morning. You have to follow through with the actual action. Even if it means you don't go for a run, I would encourage people to still put on the shoes and still leave the house. Thereafter, you know, we can tackle it step by step.
Yeah.
But visualization helps us create new pathways so that we can begin to step into this new version of ourselves, these new habits that we want. So that's why manifestation can really work, because you're visualizing who it is that you want to be in the future and take yourself out of the comfort of the known.
So now I'm thinking about myself visualizing making a lot of money, right? A lot of people would love to visualize making £10,000.
Yeah.
How do I manifest making £10,000? What's the process I go through?
I'm not a manifestation expert, but I would say, you know, visualizing what are the kind of habits, behaviors that you would embark on to be somebody that's earning that kind of money. Why you're not earning that kind of money now? Is it because you have self-limiting beliefs? Is it because you don't have enough time? All of these things that you can start putting into this kind of recipe for who you're going to be in the future. And then visualizing what it is that you have to do different. Because again, you know, your brain, the majority of it operates on automatic. So if you are in a habit of not going to the gym, I'm using the gym as an example, but you know, whatever it is for you to get to that point where you're earning whatever the £10,000 a day or a month.
Oh my God, wow, killing it.
A month. You know, so by visualizing the little steps, the habits that are involved in getting you to that point, you can start closing that gap to get there.
So can you genuinely change your brain to manifest anything you want?
I'm a big believer in yes. You know, people will sometimes scrutinize me online because they're like, oh, well, I can't be LeBron James. And I'm like, well, of course you can't be LeBron James. You're 5'4".
That's so funny.
But, you know, I'm actually doing this at the moment. So I'm 32. I'm not old at all, but I'm just started guitar. And I'm basically going to prove to myself and, you know, to my followers that you can become really, really good at anything. And I'm going to be really good at guitar. I'm not just going to, like, you know, jam Oasis. I'm going to, like, rock.
Okay.
I'll never be Jimi Hendrix, obviously. But I can get to a point where I'll be good enough. And I actually visualize myself sometimes when I'm, like, in the bath or, you know, doing things, driving. I visualize my hand movements that I'm supposed to be doing when I'm changing chords. Because one of my things is I struggle to change chords quick enough, and I visualize it. And this is really interesting. This is like a little bit of an anecdote. I used to do ballet. My right leg is super nimble. I can do like a full extension. Okay. My left leg, I can't. And when I visualize it, I can't visualize my left leg getting any higher, which is really weird.
No.
Because my pathways that dictate how far up my leg can go I'm not there. So when I visualize it, I have to do it like a step by step, a little bit higher, a little bit higher.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, that's a personal anecdote, which I found really interesting. But the data on visualization is not woo-woo stuff. It's well established in the literature. For example, they did a study with athletes and they actually showed that the cerebellum, which is responsible for coordinating movement, knowing where things are in space. So, you know, when you are, it's called proprioception. When you, you know, hit a ball, you have to A, know how far it is before you hit, how hard to hit, at what angle to hit. They actually showed, you know, increased activity in the cerebellum just through visualization. So it was improving their activity in the cerebellum by visualizing that they were going to move better. So it was improving athletic performance because they were visualizing the movements first and then performing them after mental imagery training.
Oh my gosh. So this is where I want to apply it to the everyday person. If visualization is so powerful, if I'm sitting at home and I've just gone through a breakup and I visualize me being happy in a relationship, what's the correlation?
Being happy in another relationship.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And it's one of the tips that I give on breakups is visualize yourself in a happy relationship or happy without the person that you've just come out of a relationship with. Because the brain, you know, it has ways of ruminating over breakups and trying to correct what you've done wrong. What could I have done? What could I have done differently? And remember, I spoke to you about how the brain has this error detection area and we always want to try and improve. And that's why we can go down this rabbit hole of trying to fix things, even though you can't. So you're better off, you know, diverting your energy into something that you can change, which is how you're going to feel in a week's time, in a month's time, in 3 months' time, to aid that feeling of going through a breakup. And then, you know, if you have parts of the relationship that you're perhaps carrying into new ones, that's a very classic one. Perhaps someone was, infidelity. You go into a new relationship and you start thinking that that person's also going to do that. So then you start finding little things to prove your belief. So it's, we're doing a full circle here. You start finding reasons to prove your point that this person is also going to do that to you. And then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then you're reinforcing this pattern.
What is a self-fulfilling prophecy?
So if you think that your partner's going to cheat on you and then you try to find reasons, you start pushing them away, they start getting a little bit freaked out by your behavior, and then perhaps they do. Hopefully they don't, but perhaps they do. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And then it happens and you're like, I knew it.
Yeah.
So you kind of create a situation for yourself that didn't necessarily need to happen.
Exactly.
I remember listening to Mel Robbins once, and she was saying, there's no difference in you thinking something and your brain actually doing it, right? Which is what you've just explained with kind of not tennis example, you've just explained with the visualization example.
Yeah.
How does that work? So what I think about it is, let's say I want to start a new habit of reading books.
Yeah.
If I visualize myself reading books, how does my brain not know the difference?
I would visualize the step process that it takes for you to get to the point where you're reading books. Because what tends to happen is people are probably scrolling at night, right?
Yes.
Guilty as well. Yeah, no, we're all human, right? So I visualize myself getting my thing is like I have to have a bath every night.
Yeah.
I don't like showers.
I don't really like shower either.
Don't clip that into a 1 second clip. I don't like showers. Nicole's neuroscience does not shower.
Love it.
No, so just to backtrack, yeah. So I visualize myself getting out of the bath, you know, doing my skincare routine, whatever, getting into bed, picking up the book instead of the phone. I actually put my phone in a different room because if the phone's there, you have all these subconscious cues that are saying, pick up your phone. It's there. It's right there.
Just take you're 2 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same concept of when you walk into the kitchen, you're like, oh, I want cookies. You weren't thinking about cookies until you got there, you know, because there's a lot of subliminal cues that are triggering you to perform the habit that generally occurs in a sequence.
A lot of people talk about confidence and they say that you're born with confidence. Do you believe that someone can trick themselves into being confident?
It's not about tricking, you know, it's about finding evidence. So you say, okay, I've got a public speaking event. And the first time I was like, okay, I don't know how this is going to go. It was a bit scary. It went well. Okay, proof that went well.
But what if it doesn't go well? What if you're like,
then you correct. You're correct. There's no real such thing as failure, right? The way that I describe it is your brain is a piece of machinery that has software that you put on and then you upgrade it and then you put more data in and that goes wrong. You're like, okay, let's not do that again. Let's divert. And then you upgrade and you upgrade and you're always upgrading your software, right? So there's no real such thing as failure because failure is just a learning curve to know what not to do next.
But so there are some people that have said, like, look, I'm just not confident. I really want to be, but I'm just not. And I don't know how to be confident. I'm not a good public speaker. I'm a bit shy. I'm a bit introverted. I don't like it when the attention's on me. And then I can never communicate clearly because I'm not confident enough to express my perspective. What do they do?
You have to do it because you only gain confidence in places where you don't have any. You have to go to places where you don't have confidence to gain confidence, right? And prove to yourself that you can do it. Of course, if you're somebody that's shy, maybe isn't a good public speaker, wouldn't throw you on the deep end on a TEDx talk.
Yes.
But, you know, start slowly. Walk into a coffee shop, broad shoulders, order your coffee with confidence. Okay, that's evidence. We've just done that. Maybe we're not as not confident as we thought. And then you do it again where you, I don't know, you know, walk into the meeting room. Again, broad-shouldered, confident. Good morning, everyone. Oh my gosh, that went well. Evidence, I can do this. And then over time, you start to rewire your brain to be more confident.
I really like you just talked about posture there, because immediately I was like sitting like this and then I was like sitting like this and I automatically feel better. How much does our posture and I guess the way we carry ourselves impact us?
There was a study, it was called like the superhero pose study, and they showed that people that stand like this before a talk are actually more confident.
Really?
So, like Superman. And I actually do that sometimes. Not so much anymore because now I've done so much public speaking that I'm quite confident. Mm. But I would do that before and just be like, oh, you can do this, girl. Come on.
Amazing. I love that because I think, you know, this is another thing. Our physiology affects our psychology.
Yes.
And you've done a psychology master's. What are the links between, I guess, psychology of the brain and neuroplasticity?
The way that I describe psychology is the software. And then neuroscience is the hardware.
Oh, okay.
Both have to be working together. The hardware component needs to be in good functioning order for you to be able to make upgrades to the software. You know, the hardware is your brain health, sleep, exercise, hydration, nutrition, meditation, you know, stress management. And then the software is the habits, the behaviors, the personality types, the confidence, the self-limiting beliefs that you're trying to break. And you can make upgrades. I don't know if that really answers your question.
No, it does. I think what I'm trying to get out of here, what are the low-hanging fruits that people can do to really allow themselves to be in a position where they can rewire their thoughts because they've got that strong software or hardware?
Hardware. Sleep. It's one of the ones that I know.
Do you want to see what my sleep score was last night? 4 hours and 29 minutes.
No.
I saw it. I was like, I feel sick. I've had 4 coffees today as well to make up for it. So now I'm like, am I going to sleep tonight? Probably not.
Yeah, hopefully you do.
Why is sleep so linked to our anxiety?
Okay, so many things happen when you sleep. One, we release testosterone during REM sleep. In 8 hours, you will release a certain amount. By sleeping 6 hours, you're losing an entire cycle of REM. In men, the study was done in men, I appreciate, you know, but women release testosterone as well, and we need it. But in men, they showed that amounted to 10 to 15% drop in daily testosterone release just by sleeping 2 hours less.
Wow.
Which is huge. Now, the important thing is that testosterone is responsible for rewiring your brain as well. It helps us with cognitive function. It helps us with creating new pathways, synaptogenesis. Synaptogenesis is just a fancy word for creating new connections in the brain. Okay, so it's really important. We release growth hormone when we're in our deepest phase of sleep. That helps us repair cells. It helps us repair, you know, cells in the brain as well so that we can stave off neurodegenerative diseases. And then the most important one is called the lymphatic system. It's basically like a washing machine for your brain. So at night, this lymphatic system comes up with cerebrospinal fluid and quite literally cleans out your brain of toxins and buildup. We know that tau buildup is one of the buildups that leads to Alzheimer's disease. Sleep.
How many hours?
Everyone's different. I'm the kind of girl that needs 9 hours every night. Do okay. I get 9 hours? Not every night.
How do I know how much sleep I need?
I use a Whoop.
Oh, yeah, I do have Whoop.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. Most people, 7.5 to 9 hours, because your cycles are not, excuse me, your cycles are 90 minutes long. So if you add that up, it's like 1.5, 3, 6, 7.5, 9.
Got it.
So 7.5 to 9 is the recommended. Now, there's a very, very small percentage of the population that can sleep 6 hours and have the same effects as if they slept 8. Most people don't have that, though, unfortunately. I wish I had that.
How do I get that?
You can't. It's genetic.
Okay. I'm like, maybe I do. I honestly really struggle with my sleep. I don't like to. I feel anxious when I go to sleep because I'm like, there's so much I needed to do.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I'm so excited to wake up in the morning. And then in the morning, I'm like, oh my God, I hate my life. I don't want to wake up.
So what if you
change... This is just a bit of a stressful period at the moment. This is not me every day, by the way. You're like, okay, maybe you should, like, you know.
If you change that mindset, though, because, you know, to work hard and play hard, you have to recover hard as well.
Mm.
And, like, productivity, I always say the biggest part of productivity is actually recovering.
For sure. No, you know? I just think it's like I'm not winding down, so I'm, like, thinking of all the things that I get stressed out about.
Yeah.
And then in the morning, I wake up feeling anxious. So then I'm like, okay, just 5 more minutes to escape. And then... It's just actually recently I've got into this bad habit.
Yeah.
I used to be quite like regimented. I've never really slept so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that recently, because I'm feeling so stressed, at the end of every day, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go to sleep. And then I don't sleep for like 2 hours. I'll lay in bed like doing everything I can. And then in the morning I'll wake up and I'm so tired. And so it's like this bad loophole. But I also think it's like a day like today, it's very common for me to be like, I'll just keep having coffee and power through. Yeah. And then we're back into the cycle. So even actually looking at, like you said, is like repair. Like it's like nurturing, like cuddling your brain, I guess, to like really help it. What are some of the other low-hanging fruits? You mentioned water and hydration.
Water, lowest hanging fruit, water, hydration. So your brains communicate in the presence of water through electrolytes, predominantly sodium, potassium and calcium and magnesium. No need to get into the nitty-gritties, but basically just hydrating correctly. So even a 2% dehydration can cause, you know, even a 2% dehydration can impact our brain processing speed. So how quickly you process information. So if you are somebody who wants to make quick decisions, smart decisions, the right decisions under pressure, the lowest hanging fruit is making sure that you're just hydrating correctly.
Oh my God. And how much is that hydration? 2 liters, right?
2, 2.5, depending on your size. I mean, I've worked with athletes that actually go and get sweat tests done to know how much they need to, but you don't need to get that technical with it. You know, 2 to 2.5. And ideally, regularly, you know, we've been talking now for what, 30 minutes? We should probably have a little sip of water.
Really?
Yeah, we're using a lot of brain power as well having these conversations. So.
Is that why I get so tired all the time?
Yeah. And if you have a glass of water, you might even like bounce back. Actually, have you ever tracked your HRV?
Yeah, it's not great. All of my whoop is like out of, I'm always like, this doesn't work. Like it's not working at the moment for me. Because it's like all out of sync. It's always like, you don't sleep. You're in like 2% recovery. I'm like, okay then, bye-bye. Thank you for letting me know. I want to talk about that actually, because placebo is kind of linked to what we're talking about. Do you believe in the placebo effect?
Yes. Very powerful.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, talk to me about it.
I will talk about something that I definitely spoke about in the book, which is closely linked. So they did a study where they took two groups of people. They told one group that this milkshake was super decadent, very calorific, very delicious, yummy, yummy, yummy. And then they told this other group that this is a sensible shake, low fat, low calories. And what they saw was that the individuals that drank the sensible shake, the low-calorie shake, started releasing ghrelin, which is a hormone that tells you you're hungry, sooner than the group that were told that the milkshake was very calorific. Okay, so your physiology changes according to your belief and mindset.
Wow.
Yes, so the placebo effect... You know, people sometimes shun the placebo effect. And I'm like, look, unless you're taking crazy supplements and doing crazy things with your body, the placebo effect, you know, our belief around what we're doing to some degree is really powerful and can be beneficial for us. So if wearing your whoop works for you, for example, or I don't know, taking electrolytes, I'm just giving examples.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, saying you have to do these things. If these things work for you, then... Maybe that's a good thing.
How amazing. So if I drink water every day and I say that this water is actually going to make me smarter because it's going to make my brain work 20 times faster, could work, no?
We'll have to test that, but yeah, potentially. So backtracking, if you say to yourself, my sleep is going to make me work 10 times better tomorrow and that's why I need to prioritize going to bed at a reasonable time, I need to park my thoughts and make sure that this is restorative, you're probably going to feel better the next day. You're going to be more likely to then prioritize your sleep.
So true. So that's another way we can kind of reframe our bad habits and turn them into good ones.
Yeah.
a lot of people have some habits that they want to let go of, myself included. How do we get rid of bad habits and how do we create good habits?
Okay, I love this question. So if you have a particular path that your brain is usually taking, be it smoking, be it eating the cookies when you don't want to, whatever it is, I always say add on a good one at the end. Okay, so if you're trying to change something, but you're also trying to do something new, this is, you know, I'll give you a little example. Like the physiological sigh is such a great tool, you know, the double inhale, the long exhale. Okay, so what I tend to say to my clients and in the book is put the good habit at the end of the bad one, so that there are a couple of things. When you perform the bad habit, let's use smoking as an example because it's a classic one. People smoke and then they beat themselves up about it. Mm. Your brain has learned that it can smoke and you're just going to gain control of the situation by beating yourself up about it. So it doesn't matter if you do it again. You think it matters, but subconsciously your brain is saying, well, every time we do it, we just gain control of it by just beating ourselves up. So even if we do it, it's okay because we'll have one way to rectify it. And that keeps us in a loop that's stuck. If you add something good at the end, drinking a glass of water, maybe having an affirmation, maybe doing the physiological sigh, that means that you're adding on a positive at the end of a negative. So the next time you are triggered to smoke, you go, okay, but actually that also reminds me to drink my water. Because the brain works on cues and triggers, you know, cue, habit, reward. So a cue is whatever it is, like, oh, I feel like smoking. And you're not going to remember to probably do the affirmations or the positive things until you have a cue. So you can use the bad habit as your cue.
Wow.
So over time, you start going, okay, I really want to smoke, but Nick told me that if I do the physiological sigh and I drink my water and I do an affirmation afterwards, eventually you'll fast track to that and you'll start dismantling that firing pattern that says this is the automatic thing that we normally do.
Wow. But won't that just get into another habit? Like this is step one, two, three, because you're repeating it.
What do you mean?
Like the step one is the cigarette, the step two is the affirmation, the step three is the water.
Generally speaking, over time, you'll start to, because the smoking is like an automatic thing that just happens. Then you beat yourself up about it. And it kind of happens very fast. You have this kind of like fast brain type thinking. But by having these in sequence, you'll start to see the pattern as a kind of more bigger picture. You know, you might not get it right the first time. You probably won't get it right the first time. But over time, you'll start to kind of go, okay, actually, I probably don't want to smoke.
So do you believe that anyone can break any bad habit?
Yes.
100%.
I mean, you know, cases of addiction are very different because there's actually, you know, the way that the wiring is happening in the brain, there's a disconnect between the frontal cortex. It's much, much more complex with, you know, substance addictions.
Okay.
But generally speaking, when I spoke to an addiction psychiatrist from Brown University, he gives similar tools where he helps his patients not beat themselves up about the behavior that they've just performed because it keeps us stuck. You know, I've added on the positive thing, but he says to not, to kind of get down to the bottom of it. Like, why do you want to smoke? What's triggering you to smoke? Can you change that trigger so that you don't smoke? Can you replace it with something else? How does smoking make you feel? And when you start getting into the whys of things, you start to, again, gain control of the situation. You're recruiting that frontal cortex that I spoke about earlier. Yes. Instead of operating through this emotional brain that says, go, just smoke. You can beat yourself up about it later.
Amazing. Honestly, you've taught me so many incredible things for this podcast. I feel like we need like a podcast in each chapter of the book. What is one tool you'd recommend someone to do every single day that could help them think more positively to change their life?
One thing that I tell everybody to do is self-trust. If you say you're going to do something, stick to it. I will guarantee if you do that for 30 days, you will change your life. Because if you can trust yourself, you can go through life easier, right? If you say, I'm going to go to the gym at 6 a.m., I would never say that. But some people do say that.
Yes.
And also that's the other thing, you need to be realistic. You know, you can't be like, I'm going to go to the gym at 6 a.m. and then do, you know, skydiving in the afternoon.
Yeah.
It has to be, realistic. And that's where people tend to go wrong. January comes, they're like, I'm going to go to the gym 5 days a week. I'm going to go and change my diet. I'm going to do this. I'm going to stop drinking soda. I'm going to stop smoking, stop drinking. And then it's too much for the brain. We have to be more realistic. But keeping promises to yourself is single-handedly the most valuable tool, in my opinion, that you can have.
Why is that?
In creating self-trust, in creating confidence, in creating self-worth. Know your self-worth is one of the biggest drivers of why we behave in particular ways. If you've got self-worth, you'll be able to change your habits.
So powerful. I mean, the exercise that we did around the ideal person, I'm still thinking about that, by the way. I really think that was so eye-opening. And I'm so excited to go into the other exercises in your book. You know, I've skimmed through it at the moment. I feel like it does. I'm like learning so much at the same time. So I want to like savor every chapter.
Yeah.
Because I also think, you know, like I'm somebody that like when I read it, I'll be like, okay, now how can I put that into practice? And so I think that's what's so great. There's so many exercises, so many diagrams, there's so many tools within that.
Yeah.
When is the book out?
9th of May. The other great thing about the book is that I encourage you to read it, you know, from top to bottom, but you can come back to the chapters at every point and not needing to have read them again.
Yes.
They kind of work as little tools in themselves. So each chapter is a tool.
And that's how I've been looking at it as well, right? Yeah. So I think I've done the first three, but then I won't move on to like the next ones because I'm like, I need to implement that first. Yeah. And I think that I've noticed that about myself. I'll like read a whole book and then I want to go back to like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's one of my favorite books. Right. I've only ever enacted like 3 of those because I just have to do one habit at the same time. Yeah. And then I have to go back and read it. So I think for me it works in that way. But I'm so grateful that you made this trip work. I know that you've come from far. I know that you're jam-packed for the next 2 days. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad we can make it work. So
thank you.